Mr. Kelly is returning today, but unfortunately for you, not in time for this class. So here I am again. He asked me today to cover the subject of Nero and the persecution of the early church, so I will. Now, as you probably have already discussed, the Church of God at first was viewed primarily as a Jewish sect, and it was treated as such by the Roman authorities. But things began to tighten under the reign of the Roman Emperor Claudius. He reigned between the years 41 to 54, during the early years of the church. I mentioned the last time I was here that Simon Magus had come to Rome during his reign in 45 A.D. In 50 A.D., Claudius commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. So we here now we begin to see some anti-Semitism rearing its head. Acts 18 and verse 2 is the reference there. The Roman biographer Suetonius, S-U-E-T-O-N-I-U-S, writes about this persecution in his famous work entitled The Lives of the Caesars, which is a very interesting book, which I would highly recommend. A great deal of what we're going to discuss this morning is found in that work. So the Church of God, being identified as a Jewish sect, felt some of this anti-Semitism that began around this time. I should mention that at this time Paul was in Corinth. In verse 11 of Acts 18, we read that he spent a year and a half there, which would have been from the fall of 50 A.D. to the spring of 52. And we also read in that same chapter that Aquila and Priscilla, who were Jews and had been living in Italy, had come to live in Corinth because of this decree of Claudius in 50 A.D. Now on the board here, I've placed some names. You see Claudius, the Roman emperor, his two children, two among a number of them, Britannicus and Octavia. Claudius married his niece, Agrippina, called Agrippina the Younger, to distinguish her from other Agrippinas in early Roman history. Now, this Agrippina was the mother of Nero, as I illustrate there. And Agrippina persuaded Claudius to adopt Nero, not only to adopt him, but to adopt him as heir to the throne, in place of his own son, Britannicus. And after all that was signed and sealed and the will was prepared, Agrippina proceeded to poison Claudius. And guess who became emperor? Her son Nero, at the age of 16. And that was in the year 54 A.D. And at this time, Paul would have been on his third missionary journey, which extended roughly 53 to 56 A.D. And by the way, Nero was the Caesar that Paul appealed to. There in Acts 25 and verse 11, when he said, "I appeal to Caesar," it was to Nero, who began reigning now in 54. Now the young emperor, upon assuming the throne, announced his intention of governing well and wisely, and at first he seems to have made some serious effort to attend to his duties, but it was not long before he became tired of serious work. And beginning around the year AD 59, he began to change. Most of the historians say that he was something of a model sovereign until AD 59. But in that year, he put his mother, Agrippina, and his stepbrother to death. Tradition says that Paul landed in Rome the very day that Nero killed his mother. Nero had a little trouble disposing of her. One of the first things he tried was he sent her on a sailing excursion in the Bay of Naples in a boat that was designed to sink. And fortunately for her, unfortunately for his plans, he didn't realize his mother was such a good swimmer. And she made it to shore safely after the boat sank. So after various other ill-fated attempts, he finally simply had her put to death at her country house and gave up the idea of making it look like an accident. Nero was a man of unbounded vanity. He fancied himself to be a great artist, an actor, a musician. He was very extravagant, and this extravagance necessitated very heavy taxation from the provinces to support his extravagance. And this, of course, provoked unrest and made a great number of enemies for Nero outside of Rome. In Rome itself, Nero's bizarre private and public actions eventually alienated many of the powerful Romans. So he was gradually making enemies on all sides. Let me quote from Frank Bourne's book, The History of the Romans, regarding Nero's character. The crimes of Nero's reign were infamous and patent. They were the more dreadful because Nero himself was a physical and moral coward. His adoptive brother Britannicus was poisoned early in the reign because he might prove a rival. His mother's ambition and her disapproval of his unstatesmanlike devotion to the arts and to his mistresses caused him to have her murdered as well in AD 59, as I mentioned. It talks about his crimes and moral and physical degeneracy here. In Acts 28, verses 30 to 31, we discover that Rome at that time was not yet hostile to Christians. Paul was free to work and to teach for 2 years in his hired house in Rome. And that was between the years 59 to 61 A.D., those 2 years in Rome, Acts 28, verse 30 to 31. And we don't see anything there regarding hostility to Christians at that time. That would come a few years later. I should also mention that Paul probably faced Nero in some sort of a minor audience, since he had officially appealed to Nero. Remember, he said, "I appeal to Caesar," there in Acts 25. So, having made an official appeal, he probably did appear before Nero, though that is not recorded in the book of Acts. In Rome, there is a chapel called the Palatine Chapel, and inside that chapel there's a fresco which depicts Paul conversing with Nero, so that very probably does have some historical basis, just in view of the legal system and the fact that he would have had to have followed through on that appeal. Paul was freed in AD 61, after those 2 years, and he traveled for 7 additional years. He died in AD 68, so there were 7 years between 61, his release, and his death in 68. Tradition says he went to Spain and to Britain. That's a subject in itself. I'll just mention to you a book that can be had in the college library called St. Paul in Britain. The author is R. W. Morgan, M-O-R-G-A-N. So if you want details about his trip to Britain, you can consult that work. Of course, these travels do not appear in the book of Acts, and we have suggested that since the book ends so abruptly and there's no salutation at the end, that possibly God has left the book of Acts open so that Paul's further travels might be added later, as well as the acts of subsequent eras of the church, including our own. So that is a possibility. So Paul was freed in 61. The next year, 62, Nero put to death his wife Octavia, the daughter of the previous emperor Claudius. And then, moving ahead further in time, coming to the year 63 or maybe early 64, we begin to read that Nero was becoming drawn to preachers of novel religious cults. Rome was a city of many different religions, and there were many cults that were prevalent in the city, and Nero began to investigate these cults. He had a certain interest in unusual religions and strange gods and that sort of thing. And among these preachers that he was drawn to was the Gnostic magician Simon Magus. As I mentioned the last time I was here, there was another individual, a miracle-working pagan teacher by the name of Apollonius of Tyana, T-Y-A-N-A, who was kind of a Simon Magus-like person, totally pagan. He never pretended to adopt elements of Christianity. This Apollonius was a miracle worker, just as Simon Magus was, and this sort of thing fascinated Nero, so he began to dabble in religions at that time. Unfortunately, never seriously pursuing the true Church of God, just the opposite. We now move ahead to the year 64 A.D., and this is a monumental year for the church. It was in that year that Rome caught on fire, and for 6 days and nights, this great fire raced out of control through the most populous districts of the city. 10 out of Rome's 14 precincts were destroyed by fire, and many of the architectural glories of ancient Rome were devoured in the flames. This was also a terrible human tragedy. Let me quote from a book by Weigel entitled Nero regarding this fire. For 6 days the city blazed, and then when the catastrophe was thought to be over, the flames broke out again and continued their destruction for 3 days more. During the blaze, panic took hold of the citizens. And during the first days of the blaze, the confusion was appalling. The screams of the women and children, the cries and shouts of the men were incessant. And the noise and smoke, the crashing of buildings, and the heat and glare of the leaping flames bereft the people of their senses. Distractedly they ran to and fro, often finding themselves hemmed in when they had waited too long in helping the aged or the infirm to escape, or in salvaging their goods. In the sudden panics and rushes which occurred as street after street was attacked, scores of people were trampled underfoot or suffocated. Scores more were burnt to death as they attempted to rescue their friends or relations or to save their belongings. And it is said that many went mad and flung themselves into the flames which had destroyed all they loved or possessed, or stood dumb and motionless while their retreat was cut off. To add to this confusion, thieves were soon at work, assaulting and robbing the householders who were carrying their treasures into the streets. Well, that paints a picture of this terrible conflagration that was taking place. Now, the Christians in Rome very probably thought that this was the end of the age when you read this description, and probably expected the heavens to open at any time and for Jesus to return. You'll realize, of course, that at this time they did not have the benefit of the book of Revelation, and consequently didn't realize specifically some of the things that had to occur before the end of the age. And so very probably they were hoping for Jesus' return at any moment. Certainly they must have known that the Empire of Rome was the fourth beast of Daniel 7. So they probably saw this fire as God's vengeance on the beast and a sign of his of Jesus' soon coming return. But some Romans, in the meantime, were suspecting that Nero had personally triggered this blaze, or that his agents had. I said he fancied himself to be quite the artist and musician. He also fancied himself a great builder, an architect. And many were suspected that Nero desired to simply erase the old city of Rome so that he would have the glory of founding a new and a grander city, Nero's Rome. And this became quite a prevalent suspicion, and Nero began to fear for his safety. So, logically, he had to find someone to bear the blame and to divert the suspicion away from himself. And we know the group that he chose. He blamed the Christians of Rome. Now, this was the logical choice. The Christians, of course, refused to worship the old Roman gods. They refused to honor the emperor as a divine being. And in preaching a new king, in other words, Jesus, preaching this new king who would replace the emperor, well, this sounded like revolution. So he branded them revolutionaries as well. The Christians had no influence or power, and they simply were the perfect scapegoats. And also, one thing I should add is that the Christians did not help to put out the fire. And that moved public sentiment against them. Let me give you a quote in this regard. Again, from the book Nero by Weigel. That's W-E-I-G-A-L-L. Also, it was reported that during the blaze, when asked by their distracted fellow men if they were glad to see Rome burn, the Christians replied that this was heaven's fiery vengeance for which they were waiting. Well, maybe that wasn't quite the wise response. But they replied that this was heaven's fiery vengeance for which they were waiting. Nor would they raise a hand to extinguish the flames. And possibly they looked upon this, again, as God's vengeance on Rome. So, you know, why should they attempt to counteract the vengeance of God, I guess? You know, you can understand why the Christians there would not have tried to fight the fire. But, again, this moved the public sentiment against them. The Lord's immediate return, continuing with this quote, in actual fact, was the mainspring of their faith, the second coming being the supreme event which the elect were hourly expecting. And so great a disaster could not have been thought to be anything but the beginning of this tremendous advent. They thought Jesus was coming. The heavens would open now at any moment, and they would see him riding upon the fiery clouds. So that that explains the frame of mind of the Christian community. So Nero began his persecution of the church, and he was supported by the public in this. It was an open season on Christians. Let me quote now from Tacitus, the Roman historian, from his work The Annals, A-N-N-A-L-S. This is just part of his account of the persecution. First were arraigned those who confessed, probably by torture. Then, on their information, a vast multitude were convicted, not so much on the charge of arson as for their hatred of the human race, quote-unquote. Their deaths were made more cruel by the mockery that accompanied it. Some were covered with skins of wild beasts and torn to pieces by dogs. Others perished on the cross by crucifixion, or others were burned in the flames. And yet others were covered with tar and were burnt after sunset as torches to light up the darkness. Nero himself granted his gardens for the show and gave an exhibition in the circus and dressed as a charioteer and drove his chariot himself during some of these exhibitions where Christians were killed. So some of these executions were very cruel, as you see here. In fact, the persecution of the Christians was so severe, and the way that they died, as I just described there, many of these ways were just so excruciatingly painful, that many of the pagan Romans began to feel some pity for the Christians who were being martyred. And here again from Tacitus, just one sentence in that regard. And of course, Tacitus would have viewed the Christians as deserving of punishment, as he says here, but not quite to that extent. He says, thus, guilty and deserving the severest punishment as they were, the Christians were yet pitied, as they seemed to be put to death, not for the benefit of the state, but to gratify the cruelty of an individual. So it wasn't that the public objected to Christians being put to death, but many of them objected to the way that they were being put to death, to gratify the cruelty of Nero, who was doing things, as I just described, like coating them in tar and putting them on stakes and lighting them for illumination at night at his garden parties and that sort of thing. But still, many Romans continued to suspect Nero of starting the fire. He had not succeeded completely in doing away with that particular idea. But nevertheless, the persecution continued. Of course, in one sense, the Christian community should not have been surprised. For many years prior to the start of this persecution, Paul was continually warning the church that persecution would come. Now, he reminded them of the words of Jesus, who said that if they have persecuted me, they will persecute you. There are many scriptures in this regard. In 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12, Paul warned that all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. There are many other scriptures where he warned of coming persecution. So now at least the Christians in Rome are experiencing some of this in a very cruel way. And it was during this Neronian persecution that Paul himself, the apostle to the Gentiles, was taken. He was taken by Nero and imprisoned again and would meet his death under the hand of Nero, or at least by Nero's agents. I just might mention here as an aside, in 2 Timothy 4, in verse 17, the lion that is mentioned there might refer to Nero himself. It's been suggested in many commentaries that the lion there is Nero, but Paul didn't want to name him specifically in a letter of that nature. Just to give you the details, because again, this is a story in itself, but some just brief details here. Paul was beheaded in the early summer of A.D. 68 as a result of being caught up in this persecution. Undoubtedly had gone back to Rome to assist the Christian community there in their time of trial, and then was apprehended, beheaded in the early summer of A.D. 68, buried on the Ostian Way, O-S-T-I-A-N. The Ostian Way was one of the major highways leading out of Rome. And not only Paul, but many of the elders and the leading members of the congregation in Rome were also martyred in this Neronian persecution. And that, I might mention, explains, in part, why Rome became an early center of heresy and was so susceptible to false teachers. Because the elders and the leading members who were more visible, were martyred in the persecution, leaving a shepherdless flock susceptible to false teachers. More about that a little later. I should also mention that Peter also met his end in Rome in A.D. 68, another victim of the Neronian persecution. He was not beheaded, as Paul was, but of course was crucified, as Jesus had foretold back there in John 21, verses 18 to 19. And the tradition is that Peter said that he was not worthy to be crucified in the same manner as Jesus was, so he requested that he be crucified upside down. A third individual, and you'll recall I mentioned this last time, Simon Magus also died in Rome in that year, A.D. 68. He, however, was not a victim of the persecution. As I explained before, he died, according to the tradition, while attempting to impress Nero with his ability to fly. Jumping off one of the high areas there in the Roman Forum and falling to his death, not succeeding in flying. As I mentioned before, many of these magicians back in Roman times are said to have been able to fly, and undoubtedly Simon Magus was able to do that, of course, with the help of a demon. But as Justin Martyr mentions in his work, Peter, or by the prayers of Peter, who had not yet been crucified at this time, because of the prayers of Peter, the demon that would customarily carry Simon Magus around in the air was required to release him. And Simon Magus fell to his death. So all this was in the year AD 68. Paul being beheaded, Peter's crucifixion, and Simon Magus' death. So it was quite a bloody year in Rome. Now, unfortunately, the headquarters church in Jerusalem was in no position to render effective assistance to the persecuted Christians in Rome, because the headquarters church in Jerusalem was also caught up in upheaval stemming from the Jewish wars with Rome. Now, just to quickly summarize what is occurring now back in Palestine at the same time this persecution is going on in Rome. In AD 66, the oppressed Jews of Palestine had erupted into a general revolt. The Roman imperial procurator in that year had actually seized the vestments of the Jewish high priest during the annual Passover celebration, and he demanded a payment from the temple fund in order to return the high priest's outfit. And of course, that was just the last straw for the Jews, and they erupted into revolt. So Nero responded by sending General Vespasian, Vespasian, to Palestine to deal with the situation. And I'm sure you're all aware that Palestine was a Roman province at this time. And due to the efforts of Vespasian, the rebellion was gradually brought under control. Now, I should mention here, very briefly, some information about a prominent Jew of this time, who is known to us today as Josephus, the Jewish historian. He had been born in Jerusalem. He was a Jew of a priestly family, a Pharisee. And beginning in 66, he began to fight in the Jewish war against the Romans. But he was captured by the Romans. And during this captivity, or this imprisonment, he, according to his own account, had a vision from God, which indicated that Vespasian would one day become emperor. So he made this known to Vespasian, that God had revealed that he would become emperor one day. And 3 years later, just jumping ahead in the story, 3 years later in 69, when this prophecy was fulfilled and Vespasian became emperor, Josephus was released. Now, Josephus was hated by the Jews as a traitor because he did change sides, and he did support Rome in certain ways. For example, Josephus acted as interpreter for Titus, the son of Vespasian, during the siege of Jerusalem. I'll mention something about that siege in a moment. Later, Josephus accompanied Titus to Rome, where Josephus was given a pension and awarded Roman citizenship. He then became a writer, and he authored his two famous works, Wars of the Jews and the larger work, Antiquities of the Jews, both of which are available in the college library. and are very valuable works for any serious student of the Bible. The complete works of Josephus are available in the college bookstore, both in hardback and paperback. So I wanted to add that in at this point because he is an individual of importance and was tied up in this revolt. There was now political chaos in the city of Rome. Nero had gone so far that many just could not take his bizarre behavior any longer, and Nero was forced from the throne. The plan was to crucify him. His enemies were going to actually crucify him, but Nero fled, and when he realized the jig was up, as they say, he stabbed himself in the throat with a dagger, committed suicide, and that was late in AD 68, the same year that he had Paul and Peter executed. He just died later in that year by his own hand. And as he did so, Nero declared, these are his last words recorded by Suetonius, "What an artist the world is losing." What an artist the world is losing. Nero is the last emperor who belonged to the family of Augustus. He was succeeded briefly by a general named Galba, but civil war again broke out and Galba was murdered. There were a number of emperors who ruled just for a few months at a time, then they were overthrown, and it was just total chaos in Rome. Vespasian then returned to Rome and ended up becoming Caesar or emperor, and the prophecy of Josephus was fulfilled, and Vespasian succeeded in restoring peace to the city of Rome. And while he was in Rome, Vespasian had left his son Titus back in the Middle East in charge of the Roman legions. And it was in the spring of AD 69 that Titus, a very young general at the age of 29, Titus swept from the east of the Jordan River into Judea with his legions. He was going to put an end to Jewish revolt once and for all. The Christians in Palestine escaped calamity by journeying northeastward to the out-of-the-way city of Pella, P-E-L-L-A, in the Gilead Mountains east of the Jordan River. And I'm sure you've all heard details about the church's flight to Pella at that time. I won't go into that in detail. I will read what Josephus has to say regarding how the Jews were warned to flee as the armies of Titus came into the area. Now, actually, only one group really understood the sign that I'm going to describe here, and that was the Christians who fled to Pella because they knew what it said in Luke 21, verses 20 to 21, about fleeing to the mountains and so on. But let me tell you what Josephus says in his book, The Wars of the Jews, book 6 of that work, chapter 5. "I suppose the account of it would seem to be a fable, were it not related by those that saw it, and were not the events that followed it of so considerable a nature as to deserve such signals. For, before sunsetting, chariots and troops of soldiers in their armor were seen running about among the clouds and surrounding the cities. Moreover, at that feast which we call Pentecost, as the priests were going by night into the inner court of the temple, as their custom was, to perform their sacred ministrations, the priests said that, in the first place, they heard a quaking, and heard a great noise. After that, they heard a sound as of a great multitude saying, 'Let us remove hence.'" So there was this voice as of a great multitude saying, "Let us remove hence." This voice from the temple. And again, very few Jews heeded that warning. But the Christians did remove hence and fled to Pella, as I explained. And in this flight, let me just read from another work here called The History of the Primitive Church. Before the siege of Titus, the Christians left the city by a prophecy which had been revealed to the leaders of the Church of Jerusalem. The faithful were admonished to leave the city before the war and to go and live in a town in Perea called Pella. They accordingly withdrew there, and thus the metropolis of the Jews and all the land of Judea was completely abandoned by the saints. There were no Christians in Jerusalem or Judea by the time Titus arrived there. They had all fled to Pella. Now, this flight would have required God's miraculous intervention and protection, because they would have been fleeing under very difficult conditions. Let me quote now from a book by Brandon called The Fall of Jerusalem and the Christian Church. These Christians would have had to pass unmolested through a considerable tract of insurgent country, patrolled as it was undoubtedly at such a time by bands of nationalist troops. They would have had to succeed in eluding the attention of their zealous countrymen and travel safely, with some proportion of their goods, through territory now held by the Romans and probably still carefully patrolled. Yet they did make their way safely, even under those conditions, to Pella. I'm sure this will have some parallel in the future in terms of the church going to a place of safety, again under very difficult conditions, yet under the miraculous intervention and the protection of God. I should mention that Christians at this time were referred to generally as Nazarenes, because, of course, Jesus was from Nazareth. You remember there in Acts 24 and verse 5, it talks about the sect of the Nazarenes, referring to the Church of God. And if you were to consult the Encyclopedia Britannica or other works about the Nazarenes, they would be described as a Jewish Christian sect because of their keeping of the Sabbath, of course, and so on, and other practices that were regarded as Jewish, such as the eating of clean meats and so on. The Pella congregation, I should also add, still considered itself the Church of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem Church. The chief elder in Pella was still referred to as the pastor of Jerusalem. They just viewed the church as being in exile for the moment because of the Jewish wars with Rome. I'll just to briefly recount what happened. Of course, now the Christians are in Pella. Titus now sweeps into the area and conquers Jerusalem. The Temple Mount fell to Roman forces in late August of A.D. 70. We're now up to the year 70. The Romans burned the Temple of Herod to the ground. They tore down its foundations. The city was completely laid waste. And most historians have focused on the figure of 600,000 Jews being slaughtered in that conquest of Jerusalem. 600,000 Jews. And many thousands of others were sold into slavery. It was a time of unparalleled calamity. And again, probably many Christians thought that this was part of the Great Tribulation, and that Jesus' return was imminent. So both Christians in Rome undergoing that horrendous persecution there, and the Christians in the Middle East seeing what was going on there, again, they probably figured this must be the Great Tribulation with such horror and bloodshed and so on. But of course, it was not. And when Jesus did not return during or in the aftermath of these events, many Christians were puzzled and disturbed. Many began to doubt, and some of them asked the question that Jesus said would be asked. The question, where is the promise of his coming? Right, that was Paul, I guess, that mentioned that. Where is the promise of his coming? All these terrible things were occurring, which appeared to be the tribulation, yet he did not come back. Now, those who were really converted and who were close to God continued to wait and to watch patiently. They remembered what Jesus had told his disciples there in Matthew 24, verses 42 to 44. Watch, therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord does come, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes. So those who were really studying the Bible and who appreciated what was being said realized that it would be in a time that you think not. So they were patient and waited. And they also remembered that Jesus said that it would be those who endure to the end that would be saved, whenever the end was. But that group, those who were really converted and close to God, was in the minority. Many professing Christians continued to grow restless and uneasy, and they became vulnerable to false teachers and to heresy. And divisions began to set in this time now, following 70 A.D. Not to say that there were not false teachers and another gospel already being preached prior to that time. We know that even back as early as 50 A.D., Paul was talking about another gospel, another Jesus being preached. But now, this heresy really began to make headway. It had not really made as much headway up to this time, but under these new conditions, with some of this doubting and disappointment in some way that Jesus hadn't returned, now the false teachers were really beginning to make some progress, as they would have looked at it. Some began to teach that the kingdom was already there, that it was the church itself, or that it was in the hearts of Christians. You know, the kingdom of God is in your heart, as many even say today. Now, who was leading the church of God and the faithful at this time? Well, it was the Apostle John. We're now, as we're moving ahead in the decades after the conquest of Jerusalem, for more than three decades after the death of Peter and Paul in AD 68, the church was under the sole leadership of the Apostle John, all the way up to the turn of the century. Now, when John died in the city of Ephesus around the turn of the century, and he was no longer there, you know, he was the last surviving apostle, and he was able to some extent, to hold the church together. But when he died, then finally, everything broke loose. A full-scale rebellion broke out against the authority of God's government in the church. And the faithful elders who were working under the Apostle John, the faithful elders and the faithful members who were holding fast to sound doctrine, soon found themselves in the minority, a small minority as it was in fact. The great false church was on the rise, and those who professed to be Christians but were not were in the vast majority now, as we proceed on in the subsequent decades. I should mention that after his release from Patmos, John had trained Polycarp, the elder at Smyrna, a city near Ephesus. He had trained him, and Polycarp was a very faithful man, and he presided over the Church of God for half a century after John's death, until the mid 155, I think, was the date of the death of Polycarp. You can check on that, I'm not exactly sure. But for a half a century after John died, Polycarp was in charge, and he stood up very boldly for the truth while many were falling away and while many were beginning to side with the Catholic bishops in Rome. This false church had developed so much momentum and heresy was so rife that it was still only a small minority that remained faithful under Polycarp's leadership. Now, meanwhile, the persecutions by the Romans were continuing, the persecutions of the Christians. Of course, Nero is now out of the picture, having committed suicide, but the persecutions continued under his successors. Now, we need to understand that regardless of their doctrinal differences, whether they were apostates and heretics or whether they were faithful Christians, all of those who called themselves Christians continued to suffer persecution. It wasn't just the faithful under Polycarp and other faithful elders that were suffering this persecution. The Romans were not interested in doctrine. They didn't look into the doctrines of these various divisions of the Christian community. It was of no interest. The Romans simply persecuted everyone who used the name Christian, whether they used it correctly or whether that was just a cloak for covering up various pagan doctrines that had been introduced by Simon Magus and others. So all who call themselves Christians continued to suffer persecution. Now, I need to mention that the Romans were generally not intolerant in religion. They were polytheistic. The Romans permitted many different forms of worship and belief. The Romans even incorporated elements of the religions of conquered peoples into their own religion. So they weren't by nature intolerant. But the various sects of the Christians posed a special problem for the Romans, because the adherents of these other pagan religions very readily accommodated themselves to the worship of the Roman emperor. They would practice their own pagan religion, but they would also sacrifice at the altar of the Roman emperor. But of course, Christians could not go that far, obviously. So because they would not worship the emperor, they were persecuted, not because they were Christians per se, but because they were viewed as being disloyal to the emperor. They would not engage in emperor worship. The emperors would have allowed the Christians to practice their religion freely in all aspects if they would have sacrificed at his altar. But, that was impossible. Now, Nero had set a very cruel precedent. And during the next 250 years, there were 10 major persecutions unleashed upon Christianity. And again, whether false Christianity or true Christianity, that was not a concern to the persecutors. Now, these 10 persecutions, which go all the way from the time of Nero — Nero is generally not counted, that was the initial persecution, there are 10 additional ones after his — they go all the way up to the time of Constantine the Great for the next 250 years. They are listed and briefly described in the back of Haley's Bible Handbook, which is a ready reference. The first of the 10 was under the Emperor Domitian, D-O-M-I-T-I-A-N, beginning in the year A.D. 96. Domitian was the younger son of Vespasian. He was a brother of Titus. Domitian instituted a persecution against the Christians on the charge of atheism. He said that their refusal to participate in emperor worship was atheism, so he persecuted them on that charge. I should also mention that it was Domitian who banished the Apostle John to the Isle of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, where John received the revelation. Trajan was the next one. He began his persecution in the year A.D. 98. And again, you can consult Haley's Bible Handbook or other reference works for the list of the entire 10 persecutions. I might mention that Simon, or Simeon, the brother of Jesus, that you can find there in Matthew 13, verse 55, Simon or Simeon, listed as one of Jesus' brothers, he was killed during this persecution by Trajan. Well, in any case, I think Mr. Kelly will probably briefly summarize these 10 persecutions that, again, would continue all the way to the time of Constantine, and you'll talk about Constantine at a later time. So, that will suffice for today. If there are any questions, I'll take them privately after class. So you are dismissed.